Okay, can we make a start, please? Thank you. Can you make sure that you've got a copy of the handout? And if you're listening to this lecture online, then you need to make sure that you go to the English office and get a copy of the handout before you listen to it. Okay. Well, in this lecture, I'm going to be considering Edward Thomas's poetry from two different angles. So the first angle is called Modernity and Modernism. So you probably want to make a note. It's there at the top of your handout. And the second angle is going to be The Writer and Nation. So that's going to be the second half of the lecture. And these are two themes that recur a lot in the authors that you're going to be studying on this course, Literature in the Modern World, and they're useful ways of thinking about some of those writers. The other thing I was going to say was it's worth just making really good notes through the lectures so that you've got something that you can go back to. If things don't make sense immediately during the lecture, it's not necessarily a problem. It might be something that contributes later on in the year or in the seminar later in the week. So write everything down. This is also being recorded and will be put onto the LMW website online, so you'll also be able to download it as a podcast or listen to it on your laptop later in the week. So there's no excuse, really. Okay, a very brief bit of biography about Edward Thomas, first of all. He was born in 1878 in London, and he went to a grammar school there, and then he went to Oxford University from 1897 until 1900, before becoming a London-based freelance writer. He tried to become an academic, actually, in his final year at university, but he went out and got caught gonorrhea, so he was in a lot of pain during his final exams, and so he ended up with a third and not the first that he was expected. And so he had to be a writer instead of an academic. But anyway, he never looked back. He became a freelance journalist and literary writer, remained as one for 15 years, joined the British Army in July 1915, died in the First World War in April 1917. He's obviously well known for his poetry, but he also wrote lots of journalism. They reckon over 1 million words of journalism during the 15 years, plus 38 books of prose, including a novel, literary criticism, biographies, poetry anthologies, books of short stories, travel books, none of which has really received any critical attention at all. So if you want to do something new that has never been done before by literary critics in this country, it might be worth digging out some of the other stuff that Thomas wrote. And if you can bring that kind of stuff into essays or exams later on in the course, that can only do you good. A lot of it is available online now, thanks to the University of California in the last year or two. And there's an address on the handout where you can download some of his prose if you're interested. He started writing poetry at the age of 36, a bit of a late starter, November 1914, so 3 months into the First World War. And he wrote 144 poems in about 2 years. When he was sent to France in January 1917, and he died there 2 months later. So in studying his poetry, we're focusing on a tiny part of his output, all written during the First World War. And because it is written at this time, it's important to read it through the prisms of modernity and modernism. So I'm going to digress a little bit to talk about the idea of modernity and modernism before coming back to look at Thomas and trying to put Thomas in a kind of context of modernity and modernism. So first of all, modernity. Jeremy mentioned last week that many ages have seen themselves as modern, and that you could perhaps argue that the term should be seen as relative. I think I would argue differently, and that at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, in Western Europe and North America, society went through changes that were unprecedented in scale to anything that had gone before. So by describing this age as modern, or describing the modernity of this period, we're describing something that's new and of a different order to anything that had gone on before. Change happened faster and more radically, and it reached further, it changed more aspects of society than previous ideas of what was modern or previous kind of notions of modernity. So, for example, in science, we've got Einstein's special theory of relativity, which is published in 1905. You've got the discovery of the structure of the atom in 1913, the splitting of the atom in 1918, and then only 27 years later, which is not long in the grand scheme of things, we've got the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In technology, you've got the first radio contact across the Atlantic in 1901. In 1903, the first flight by the Wright brothers. In 1909, only 6 years later, the first flight across the English Channel. In 1914, 11 years after they were first invented, you've got aeroplanes being used above the trenches in the First World War. And then in 1919 came the first transatlantic flight. So within the space of 16 years, which is shorter than all of your lifetimes, obviously, we go from the first tentative flight to crossing the Atlantic Ocean in a plane. So that's a lot of change in a short time, and it fundamentally alters our perception of what humans are doing and what it means to be a human, what we're capable of doing in this world. Other changes. Britain, first urban society by 1900. London was the most populous city on the planet, but maybe a better example of the scale of the changes that people had undergone in a relatively short period of time is given by the Welsh capital, Cardiff, which in 1800 had only 1,600 people in it. It was a village. But 100 years later, thanks to the development of the Welsh valleys for mining, it was the busiest industrial port in the world, with a population of 170,000. 1909, you've got the first mass-produced car, the Ford Model T. You've also got political changes coming thick and fast. In 1900, the Labour Party in Britain was formed. 24 years later, was forming its first government. In 1906, the movement for women's suffrage, the votes for women, became prominent for the first time. In 1920, even Oxford University took on a woman student, although the last college to do so kind of held out until about 1985. In 1928, women won the right to vote. There are also campaigns which resulted in the achievement of old age pensions, some kind of universal health care, at least in Britain, if not in the United States, the minimum wage. In international terms, you've got the kind of undignified scramble for Africa right at the end of the 19th century, where the sort of European powers are dividing Africa among themselves in order to exploit its resources. And on the other hand, you've got the signs of the end of empire. For example, after centuries of oppression in Ireland, at the beginning of the 20th century, the British finally gave up their hold on the place, except for Ulster, after a war of independence which ended in 1921. So this is the first sign of one of the kind of themes that is going to be a major theme throughout this course, I suppose, which is the relative decline of the European imperial powers and the formerly oppressed peoples reasserting their own kind of cultural and political independence. And this is a theme which obviously carries on today. If you look a bit more closely at Britain, in cultural terms, you've got the launch of the Daily Mail, the first kind of halfpenny paper, or so-called new journalism, or the beginnings of the sort of tabloid kind of journalism that we're familiar with today, sort of targeted at lower, middle-class, and working-class people who were able, for the first time, to read, thanks to the sort of 1870 Education Act. You've also got the beginning of the literary market as we know it, with literature, sort of highbrow literature at one end and popular fiction at the other. All this kind of began in the 1880s, 1890s. And the amount of literary material at this time doubled in Britain. So, for example, quick example, there were 2,868 magazine titles in Britain in 1880, but by 1900, this had almost doubled to 4,799. I think in 1886 there were 900 novels, but by 1914 this had doubled to 1,600. So in a relatively short time, you've got a huge growth in the kind of literary field within Britain. And there was a kind of a bit of anxiety for the establishment in this expansion, because they were worried that ordinary people were not reading the right material, things that wouldn't perhaps morally instruct them, or things that would teach them subversive ideas. And there were also, of course, new forms of culture. It was in 1906 that the first feature film came out. So this is a sort of little taste of the changes that we mean when we say the word modernity. And I think it's important at the beginning of the course that you begin to get your heads around what this term means. And I think these changes came to a head in the First World War. Obviously lasted from 1914 to 1918. 70 million people joined up or were conscripted into the army, one army or another. 15 million people were killed. And all the industrial and technological, scientific capacities of modernity were turned into the prosecution of war, with the result that, as we know, men and women were killed more quickly, more efficiently, in greater numbers, in more macabre ways: gas, shell, machine gun, tanks, bombing from the air, than ever before. Okay, that's term number one. Term number two, modernism, a bit more tricky to define, actually, refers to groups of artists, musicians, and writers who responded to all the changes of modernity, and especially perhaps to World War I, by advocating a break from traditional ways of organising literature, art, music. So they had the idea that the old forms and the old subject matters no longer captured what it meant to live in such a radically different world. And so modernist artists in general tried to radically adapt old traditions and forms, or replace them with new ones, in order to adequately express their circumstances in this changed world, or to jolt people into thinking differently about the world around them. Modernists also formed small groups and gave themselves a name, and you heard last week of one such little grouping called the Dadaists, led by Tristan Tzara. Another group, this time based in England, were the Vorticists, and they were one of the most radical modernist groups in Britain, either before or after the First World War. And they published a magazine called Blast in 1914 and again in 1915, and one of its pages is on your handout. If you have a little look at one of the pages from this magazine, and you can see from this that it's not a traditional poem. It plays around with the layout. Do we read it from the left to right and down, or do we look at it and let the words with the biggest font sizes catch our eye? And if so, the word England maybe catches your eye, but it's kind of taken out of its usual contexts. For example, the 1,000-mile-long body of water from the Floridas, which makes us mild, might be the Gulf Stream. So England is placed geographically, but in an unconventional way. But it might also suggest some sort of fantastical trench, and thereby the war. The word blast certainly alludes to war, and it seems also used to sort of deride England as well. And there's also these allusions to modernity in there. You've got the London Colosseum, a socialist playwright, a chorus girl, vast machinery to produce, whatever that means. So the reader is bombarded with aspects of modernity that he or she can't make sense of. They just come at you as a reader, and you make of them what you will. So is this a reflection of the sort of fragmented, chaotic modern life in the very form of the poem? There are also jarring nouns and adjectives too. So how can mountains be officious? So in these ways, the poem is self-conscious about its use of language. It problematizes the easy communication between the writer and the reader, and it forces readers to be aware that they're constructing meaning in the act of reading, rather than simply receiving the writer's intended meaning. There's no identifiable speaker. There's no I voice. Instead, it seems that institutions or machines and bodiless objects seemed to be speaking to us. And this was, after all, the age when, for the first time, voices came out of things that weren't human. The phonograph, the kind of precursor of the tape recorder or the record player, something we now take for granted, but it was a shock at the time, was first developed around this time. So Blast, the magazine Blast, is therefore an attempt to find new forms which begin to capture the confusions, the exhilaration, and the newness of modernity. So in other words, it's a sort of typical modernist piece. At the other end of the scale, an example of a traditional poem would be something like In Time of the Breaking of Nations by Thomas Hardy, which is also written in 1915, and it's the second poem on the other side of the page on your handout. So, only a man harrowing clods in a slow, silent walk with an old horse that stumbles and nods, half asleep as they stalk. Only thin smoke without flame from the heaps of couch grass, yet this will go onward the same though dynasties pass. Yonder a maid and her white come whispering by. War's annals will cloud into night ere their story die. So here the form is much more traditional. You've got alternate lines of 8 and 5 or 6 syllables. It's arranged in quatrains. You've got an A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. The use of archaisms like white to mean man. A slightly awkward word order in order to meet the requirements of the rhyme scheme. So this poem is quite reassuring in a way to its readers. It seems to suggest that, yes, the war will break nations, but these changes have always happened in history. Modernity is nothing new. Rather, it is put into a kind of classical, dynastic view of history, in which everything is cyclical, nothing really changes. And this classical view is epitomised by the relation of the peasant to the land, which will always go on as some kind of organic whole. Young men and young women will always fall in love, and these things are the eternal truths which will outlive the changes caused by war. I'm summarising horribly, but you get the picture. So I've taken quite a long time to kind of give you a bit of a brief context for what's going on in 1914 at the time that Thomas starts writing. And I want to fit Thomas into this picture of traditional and modernist poetry. So if we look at the poem As the Team's Head Brass, which is on the back of your handouts, and this is in direct dialogue with Hardy's poem. I'll read it through. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed an angle of the fallow and watched the plough narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the ploughman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war, scraping the share he faced towards the wood, and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in by a woodpecker's round hole. The ploughman said, when will they take it away? When the war's over. So the talk began, 1 minute and an interval of 10, a minute more and the same interval. Have you been out? No, and don't want to, perhaps? I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why so? I should want nothing more. Have many gone from here? Yes. Many lost? Yes, a good few. Only 2 teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France they killed him. It was back in March, the very night of the blizzard too. Now if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree, and I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though if we could see all might seem good. Then the lovers came out of the wood again. The horses started for the last time, I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team. So on the one hand, Thomas's poem is traditional. It's written in broadly blank verse, lines of about 10 syllables, 5 stresses. It has a rural setting and does not seem to address the kind of big changes that are going on in the world around Thomas. Maybe. Like the Hardy poem, there's a ploughman and there are lovers. There is an identifiable speaker, and you can kind of paraphrase the poem. You can explain what it means. And it seems premised on an agreed world which is out there and which an author can communicate to a reader. However, there are also some ways in which Thomas's poem is not traditional. Unlike the Hardy poem, in Thomas's poem, the lovers, for example, are ambiguous. We all know why they disappear into the wood, but their relationship is juxtaposed against the war, and their relationship might not outlast it. I mean, maybe they're disappearing into the wood because they're about to be separated. Perhaps one is going off to fight or work in a factory. And the Hardy poem specifies the gender of the two, a maid and her white. But the Thomas poem has two men talking together of the war, one of them elegizing his dead mate, and then identifies two more people as lovers. So these two seem to have a physical relationship, which seems more casual than that of Hardy's maid and her white. And we don't know really whether they're male or female. So Thomas's poem begins to suggest, perhaps, that the war is changing the relations between the sexes. Men, the way that men relate to women, men to men, and women to women. And in that sense, it begins to bring in some of the changes that are brought about by modernity. Another way in which the poem is not traditional is in what it implies about man's relation to the land. Hardy's poem implies that man's organic relation to the land will always continue. But Thomas's poem depicts how this is not the case. The land is already changed by the war. There are only two plough teams this year. And this particular plough team is reduced to one man. His mate has died at the front. The tree that the speaker sits on would not have been there were it not for the war. And the closing lines image of the speaker watching for the last time the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team seems to imply that this rural way of life is coming to an end. So in a sense, Thomas is coming at modernity from a funny angle. He's writing a traditional poem about the experience of an individual speaker in the English countryside, but in a sense, this poem fails. Instead, it captures how things that were traditionally thought of as eternal or classical, man's relation to nature and the lover's story, are also subject to history. So Thomas's poetry, in this sense, is a self-conscious last throw of the traditional dice, you might argue. And you could even argue that the poem stretches a traditional form to breaking point. For example, the rhythm of the dialogue is in contrast to the stresses that you would expect to be imparted by the poem's form. The rhythms of the vernacular voices effectively establishing a different rhythm to that expected by the iambic rhythm of the blank verse. And the inclusion of voices lead to some odd line breaks, like if at the end of one line and he at the beginning of the next, or everything at the end of one line and would at the beginning of the next. So it's as if the dialogue and the vernacular speech injects a rhythm into the poem, which is its traditional form struggles to contain. And perhaps the next logical step is to break the traditional form more completely, something that you will probably consider when you look at Eliot next week. The imagery too suggests a world turned upside down. The blizzard can be read literally, or it can be read as a symbol of the changes caused by war or modernity, while the speaker finds himself in the strange place of an elm tree's crest next to a woodpecker's round hole. So in other words, these changed times place images that would normally have been in their rightful places. These changed times put them jarring next to each other. The speech also reveals the ploughman's black humour. If I should lose my head, hints at the mental state likely to be caused by becoming a soldier. While working on the literal level too, perhaps alluding to macabre death in which the body is decapitated. And the black humour deepens with the phrase, I should want nothing more, which carries the sort of meaning of wanting to die for king and country, and then literally when dead, wanting nothing, as well as wanting for nothing. So Paul Fussell, in The Great War and Modern Memory, book on your handout, traces a development of this black humour, which he says is characteristic of a change in the sense of humour among people in the British nation. And he sort of traces this change back to the people's experience in the First World War. And his book is on the handout. Tim Armstrong has written a really good book on the relation between modernism and the body, in modernism, technology and the body, also on your handout. So an activity that you might like to think about in your, or might likely to do in your seminars, would be to take any Thomas poem and consider how it fits into this picture of traditional poetry on the one hand and modernist poetry on the other. And you can do this with virtually any of his poetry. Okay, I'm now going to turn to the second area I want to introduce in this lecture, the idea of writer and nation. And one of the key themes of the 20th century is this emergence of different literatures in English. So writers from many nations, once colonised by the British, established their cultural and then some form of political independence from their former rulers. And this throws up all sorts of issues for writers from nations which are dominated by a colonial power, especially for those who write in the language of the coloniser. And this is a big issue, for example, for James Joyce, the Irish writer, as we'll see later this term. And Edward Thomas is normally seen as an example of a good Englishman. And if you want to read about him as an Englishman, you should look at Edna Longley's work. And there are essays on Thomas in her book Poetry in the Wars, which is on the handout. And there's another one online in the Cambridge Companion to Literature of the First World War. And there's, on this course, because there are so many of you taking the course, there's often a problem with getting books out of the library because, you know, there are 10 copies and 200 of you guys. So one of the best ways to get around this is to look at what available resources are online. And if you go to the library website, the library subscribes to the Cambridge Companions online series, which are a really good series. So many of the authors on this course, many of the key historical events or key sort of themes or critical approaches have a Cambridge Companion too. And you can access it through the library website. You can download the essays or the chapters from the library website. And so all of you could technically do that at the same time and it wouldn't be a problem. So I recommend that as a way of looking at some critical texts about the writers on the course. Another person who talks about Thomas and Englishness is Andrew Motion, the former poet laureate. And he sees Thomas as a quintessentially English poet. However, I would like to suggest that Thomas and national identity is a bit more complicated than these writers, than these critics claim, and that he might be read as a pioneering writer for an English language, Welsh literature. So I'm going to talk a bit about that. And again, when I mention quotes, they're all on the handout, back on the other side of the handout. So in 1894, in his journal Wales, the writer Owen M. Edwards, a key figure in the Welsh literary revival, and Edward Thomas's history tutor at Oxford, called for a literature that will be English in language and Welsh in spirit, which is an early definition of Welsh writing in English. And this echoes a similar movement that is going on in Ireland at the time, where the poet W.B. Yeats calls on writers to build up a national tradition, a national literature, which shall be nonetheless Irish in spirit from being English in language. And there is some evidence that Thomas responded to Edwards' call. A 1901 letter to Edwards congratulates Edwards for his new book on Welsh history. "I am sure that because I am Welsh," Thomas writes, "you would be glad to know how much I love the book." So, in this case, his straightforward self-identification, "I am Welsh," is a bit of a clue, is an important indication of how he sees himself. And the letter goes on, "Edward's book compelled me to wish that my small activities were usefully connected to Wales," and he asks Edwards to suggest any kind of work to help you and the Welsh cause. And this is really hardly surprising. Thomas, as I said, was born in 1878 in London, but he was born in London to Welsh parents. And there were about 400,000 people at the time in London who thought of themselves as Welsh. He was the first generation of his family not to be born in Wales, and he was the first generation on his father's side not to speak Welsh as a first language. He frequently visited family in the Welsh-speaking areas outside Swansea in Wales. And I think we also forget how multilingual parts of England were at that time. There was, for example, a Welsh-speaking community in Swindon, in Wiltshire, which has long since disappeared, but at the time it was quite big, centred around the railway works. And Thomas visited this Welsh-speaking community around the railway works in Swindon, where his grandfather had emigrated to and where his uncle worked as a fitter. A bit more evidence for Thomas's Welshness. Some of his best friends were Welsh language poets. Many of his books were actually written during his long periods in Wales, and many of them are about Wales. For example, there's a book called Beautiful Wales. He didn't choose the title. Published in 1905, in which he writes, "I do not believe in patriotism unless I am in Wales." And indeed, he often criticises Britain or England at this time. For example, in one review of Irish poetry, he refers to Irish poets who sing of Ireland herself with an intimate reality often missing from English patriotic poetry, where Britannia is a frigid personification. In a review of the Dublin Book of Irish Verse, he describes Irish writing in English as work which is, in a real sense, foreign, though written in English. And he declares his interest in the process by which English is used as a foreign tongue by writers who were born to it. So the paradoxical notion that English, for some writers, is both a first and a foreign language means that writers have not a medium perfectly and by long traditional use adapted to their modes of feeling and thought. So he's making the connection between national identity, language, poetic form. And I suppose these comments on Irish writers reflect his own situation as a Welsh writer, but one who's been disinherited, one generation removed from the language of his father. He wrote mainly for the London papers. It was not possible at the beginning of the 20th century to make a living as a literary journalist in Wales. But he also made the point of crossing over the border and writing for Cardiff-based papers, even though they didn't pay as much. And he wrote stories for the Cardiff-based Welsh Nationalist, including a piece called The Patriot, in which depictions of a British soldier dying abroad are juxtaposed against the soldier's memory of his childhood, in particular a visit to Wales from London, where he lives in exile. So the dying soldier remembers his father singing the songs of his country and then going to the station on his way to Wales, meeting people who were talking in the tongue in which his father used to sing, i.e. Welsh, and then the train carries a proud freight of living men looking ahead towards their country. And so the tragedy is that on the soldier's deathbed, he realises that the country that he had been fighting for was not the land of his father and of his father's fathers and of those who sang the same songs. His country was not the country that he had fought for. So the story suggests that Welsh interests are not best served by fighting these imperialist battles abroad with the British Army. So it's a bit ironic that that's the way he ends up dying. So the question then is how this Welshness informs Thomas's poetry. And I want to suggest that it informs it in two ways. Firstly, his poetry is often subversive in its treatment of England and Britain. So his poetry often undercuts what people thought of as traditional ideas about England and Britain at the time, especially at wartime. And secondly, it positively imports Welsh language meters and forms and folk stories into the English language poetry tradition. So to take the first one briefly, example of the poetry's subversion of England and Britain occurs in No One Cares Less Than I, which is on your handout, and I think page 115 of this collected. No one cares less than I. Nobody knows but God whether I am destined to lie under a foreign clod with the words I made to the bugle call in the morning. But laughing, storming, scorning, only the bugles know what the bugles say in the morning. And they do not care when they blow the call that I heard and made words to early this morning. So this is written in late May 1916, and it's a bit of a parody of Rupert Brooke's much more famous 1914 sonnet, The Soldier, which is also on your handout, in which Brooke famously writes, "There's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England," and in which the speaker's own death as a soldier is subject to an imagined future in which he's remembered with honour and his burial place is seen as a little spot of England abroad. And Brooke's ability to imagine the future is used by him as a way of encouraging present action, fighting for king and country and encouraging others to do the same. And Thomas's poem rejects all of this. His poem focuses on the early morning call to parade, the ritualised moment when the individual men are brought together and have their group identity as British soldiers reasserted. And the poem, in a way, explodes that particular myth, and in doing so, it explicitly connects that sort of inability to imagine a future, that indifference to a British national identity. So it presents a bleak view of time. The future is unknowable, and he cannot imagine a posterity in which he can look back at the present moment and make it okay. So there is only the speaker's alienation. And the words he forms in answer to his predicament, these words have absolutely no impact on his predicament. So in that sense, the poem raises the issue of the purpose of writing a poem, the purpose of the communication. The speaker seems to be speaking to himself, and his words are drowned out by a national ritual which is indifferent towards him. You might also look at another poem that you might look at to think about Thomas and the way he subverts ideas of England, Britain. The poem titled Home Three, which is also on the handout, page 104 of the Green Book of Collected. And it presents quite a political angle on the notion of home. So, for example, it describes the moment when one of a group of British soldiers on a day's walk away from their army camp mentions the word home. The word home raised a smile in us all three. And one repeated it, smiling just so, that all knew what he meant and none would say. Between three countries far apart that lay, we were divided and looked strangely each at the other. And we knew we were not friends, but fellows in a union that ends with the necessity for it as it ought. So the poem subverts any illusion of a sense of home that's shared by three soldiers who come from three different countries. And it rejects, in that sense, the wartime propaganda that attempts to unite them in the national British cause, insisting instead that each soldier's understanding of home comes from each of the three countries that they come from. So the word union is quite a politically charged word to use, especially given the historical context of the poem, written at Easter 1916, or just after, the same time as the Easter Rising in Dublin, when a group of Irish nationalists declared their independence from Britain, an event which led to the successful Irish War of Independence 3 years later, and just after lesser-known anti-war uprisings in Glasgow. So prior to the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, war in Ulster had seemed like a likely prospect, and the breakup of the Union must have seemed even more likely in the aftermath of the battles in 1916 in Dublin and Glasgow. So that line, the union that ends with the necessity for it, might be worth talking about in your seminars. On the one hand, it recognises both the likely end of the Union in a national political sense, maybe, or in the sense that men brought momentarily together as soldiers would eventually be demobbed. So is he making a political statement, or is he making more of a kind of personal statement about his situation in an army camp? It's something to talk about. So another activity that you could do in your seminars would be to look at a poem's presentation of England and Britain. How the poems are either patriotic on the one hand or subversive in their presentation. And good poems to look at here would be Lob, maybe, or The Coom. Tears is a really good one to look at in this context, or the short four-line poem In Memoriam. This is no case of petty right or wrong would be good too. You might also think about how they compare with that Brooke sonnet, The Soldier. The second aspect of Thomas and national identity is the way that his Welshness comes into the poetry and his use of Welsh meters and forms and folk stories, as if he is coming to the English language as an outsider. So a couple of quick examples. There's a tradition in the Welsh language poetry called Englyn Indol Union, which is quite a complicated Welsh form that Thomas adapts into English in Head and Bottle, the poem Head and Bottle, which is on your handout. The downs will lose the sun, white alisum lose the bee's hum. So here we've got a 10-syllable line followed by a 4-syllable line, a pattern which is broadly repeated through the poem. And the 6th syllable of the first line, sun, half rhymes with the end rhyme sum from alisum. And then the pattern of consonants in the second half of the first line, white alisum, so the L, the Z and the M sound, is copied in the first part of the second line, lose the bee's hum. Now this is obviously quite complicated stuff, but if you're bilingual or if you're really keen, you could get a handbook of Welsh language meters. It's also there in the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetics, I think. And see how many of Thomas's poems are influenced by the intricate patterns and the strict syllables and the internal rhymes of the Welsh language tradition. Again, it's never been done. People have assumed his Englishness, but actually he's doing all this quietly. One of the troubles when you look at Thomas is that most critics kind of tend to rely on the notes and the notebooks that he was writing as he was writing the poetry. But he, as he went off to fight in France, he had a big bonfire and burnt everything. So literally, there's only the letters that he sent and the poems that he wrote in their final draft. So nobody knows what went into the making of the poems from a draft or manuscript point of view. Okay, another quick way in which his poetry may be seen as Welsh writing in English is his use of Welsh folk traditions. And there's lots of little buried allusions to these all the way through the poetry. For example, the ash grove, again on the handout, page 98 of the Green Book, mentions a patriotic Welsh folk song of the same name. The song of the ash grove, soft as love uncrossed, and then in a crowd or in distance it were lost. But that moment unveiled something unwilling to die, and I had what most I desired without search or desert or cost. And the song of the ash grove is Llwyn On, which is a Welsh harp tune, and popular at the time, and the first lines of it read, all hail to you Wales, the land of my fathers, I wish I could make you immortal in song. And the poem is also written in an adapted Welsh metre. It's called the Triban, which is a four-line stanza in an AABA rhyming pattern in which the end word in the third line rhymes with a middle word in the fourth line. And it does it in this poem. So another one of the activities that you could do in your seminars, if you're really interested in this kind of thing, is to read Thomas's prose. Good ones to read would be Beautiful Wales or Celtic Tales, both available online at the addresses on your handout, or take a copy of the Welsh folk book The Mabinogion, or there are guides to Welsh literature. There's a good one, again, on the handout, edited by Mayek Stevens, and trace the connections between Thomas's poems and Welsh culture. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there. That's all. Thank you very much. Thank you.